Hi, I'm Colleen Brennan.
And I'm Janice Rodriguez.
And this is Defending Indiana. Today, we're celebrating one of the most iconic Hoosiers, author Kurt Vonnegut, joined today by the curator of the Kurt Vonnegut Museum, Chris Lefebvre. Hey, Janice.
Hey, Colleen.
I'm so excited about today's episode.
Me too.
I'm kind of geeked about it.
I love when you get geeky.
I'm feeling super nerdy and super geeky about it because can I make a confession right here?
Yes. Live in your truth, Colleen.
Thank you, Janice, for creating a safe space for me. I did not know a lot about Kurt Vonnegut. And I'm ashamed because, like, you're like, Colleen, you're so hard on yourself. I am ashamed because he was such an enormous cultural icon from Indiana. Yeah. And I think as a young person, I sort of dismissed it when I was younger and him, because I think in my 80s and 90s brain, I felt like he was more of like a masculine writer. Like the guys that I knew really liked him. And I felt like his stories were really geared toward guys. I did not understand that his ideas were universal and insanely liberating for everybody.
Wow, you said that beautifully. Thank and you, should not feel ashamed because, as I've revealed to you and will not reveal to the audience, I too am very late to the Kurt Vonnegut party. And it is quite embarrassing given the links to Indiana, Indianapolis, his style, his like belief system. I'm like, oh, we totally agree. And again, I think I kind of mentioned this off air, like there was just a time period I was reading so many men. And then also I think I lumped him in, like I was saying, with like the Kerouacs and the Burroughs. And yeah. I was like, that's for guys. And I was also trying to like seek out female authors.
Yeah.
So somehow he's on the list, but he just kind of got moved down.
Yeah.
And then I'm so glad you brought up the documentary. And then I was like, wait, this guy's like really, really important. And then I started talking to people. They're like, you haven't read Vonnegut? And right. I'm like, you know, I decided to self-flagellate in the backyard here. Right. And getting rid of my shame. And I'm just reading his, you know, and his comedians too, just like seeing his speeches and wow. Just really, God, I would have loved to have a drink with that guy. Like, so whoever hasn't, you know, jump on the train with us, if you're a huge fan, that's great. We're a little behind. We're you know, add us to the fan club now. So
yeah, we're not bandwagoning either. We're just like really happy that we've discovered it. I think the greatest thing about this podcast, Janice, is the fact that we embody what humble really means and what it means to be humbled. So I am constantly humbled by what I don't know. And I'm using that accurately. I'm not accepting an Academy Award on a stage saying, oh my gosh, this is so humbling. It's not. That's not a humbling experience.
Yeah, you're not thinking your fellow nominees. Like, yeah. You guys deserved it too.
Oh my God.
I love when they say that.
Oh my God. I want to thank all those beautiful people who came before me. Like, I am humble. No, you're not. You're having a humble brag moment and it's in front of millions of people. No, humbling is when you realize how much you don't know.
Right.
And then you admit it and you say, I didn't know a lot and I'm working on learning more. And so that's what this podcast has been for us, Janice, or at least for me. I'm not going to speak for you.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Because it gives us a chance to kind of deep dive into some of the things. And again, just kind of always bringing it back, you know, to Indiana. And I don't know why. I think too, in my mind, I got Vonnegut confused with Studs Terkel a little. Oh. But I knew Terkel had a huge Chicago connection. Mm-hmm. And that's why when it was like, wait, Vonnegut's from Indianapolis. I'm like, he is? Like, I don't know. I just started confusing people. So
yeah.
And then I happened to be in Indianapolis a couple weeks ago and I'm like, oh, there's a Kurt Vonnegut Museum. Mm-hmm. It's all coming together. So, and it's great. I'm great that documentary came out.
So let's reference
having a little bit of resurgence. Yeah.
Yeah. Let's reference the documentary.
Sure.
So the documentary is Kurt Vonnegut, Unstuck in Time. It's currently on Hulu right now and it's expansive in the director, Robert, I think I'm saying his name right. Wida. Is that, I think I'm saying it right.
I think so.
His access to Kurt Vonnegut, his friendship with Kurt Vonnegut, which grew over the course of making the documentary. Go watch it. I'm not going to get that too much into it, but it provided, I think, us with such a deep understanding when you get to the end of that documentary of just how impactful his life was and some of the demons he had to wrestle with. So anyway, Janice, finish your thing.
No. That's it. I'm glad it seems like it's all kind of coming out right now. And whenever, you know, this like documentaries come out, it's a lot of news stories about it. Then people are, you know, picking up his books again and discovering new stuff. So it's all good. It's great.
Let's talk about a little bit about like what your impressions were when you started to learn a little bit more. Like, what are the things that stuck out to you about him or about his history or facts that you discovered that you were like, whoa?
Well, I think they touch on it in the documentary too. And then I just started reading his letters and kind of reread the intro twice. It was written by Dan Wakefield, another Indiana author. They went to the same high school, mm-hmm. but he was like before him. And then somebody introduced him to Kurt Vonnegut. And you see this again over and over again. And you had mentioned that John Irving, it seemed like he really was like a mentor mm-hmm. and he really took people under his wing. Mm-hmm. And there's some parts in here that Dan Wakefield wrote about, even if he would still try to give you a good review, like sometimes he was able to review people like in got all those older papers, you know, mm-hmm. like Saturday morning, I'm going blank, but you know, the old school ones that yeah. he would write in McCall's, you know, he would like write these opinion pieces and things like that and short stories, but he would kind of, if he liked you and he saw something in you, even if that piece of work wasn't great, he'd kind of still put the stamp of approval because he knew he kind of held some kind of power, even though it was like a reluctant thing, but he right. used it for good. You know what I mean? Like Dan Wakefield recounts the story it's in the intro of Kurt Vonnegut letters and that people were just staring at him at this bar in New York and they were being all weird. They're like, are you the real Kurt Vonnegut? And he was like, well, yes, but here's Dan Wakefield. He's an amazing author. And then he's just saying how the guys were like, we don't care about this Dan guy. And it was just like really cool. Like that he recounts this. He's like, I saw him do that over and over again where he would like want to pass the mic to somebody else. So I just thought that was really cool and very Hoosier of him, you know?
Yeah. And one of the things I think that you and I just, you know, off air and as friends in the comedy world, we've both lived under sort of this mantra of, I would rather bring people up with me than push people down.
I mean, I like to push people sometimes. I'm just joking. Sometimes I want to, but still, no, I'm just joking.
But there's too much Hoosier in you?
There's too many Hoosier, yeah. Sometimes I get that region comes out. No, but you're right. Absolutely. Like I said, there's space for everybody. And I think he kind of embodies that, right?
Yeah, so. Yeah. I mean, that's what I really admire people who do that. Those are the people who are so committed to their craft and their art that they know that there's room within the framework of their art for other artists to join them. And that is what makes us all better as artists.
100%. Man, you're on your game today, Colleen.
I am.
T-shirt quotes. These are embroidered pillows that need to happen. I'm going to.
When are we starting our merch line?
We are. We need to. It's just things we said. You said you're feeling all Indiana. And I was like, region, beat down. I don't know. It's going to be light and dark. We're just going to have a light line and a dark line.
It's so funny. We have this long list of all these merch ideas that we've been, you know, adding over the past 3 years to our list. And we haven't done any of them yet, but we're going to. We're actually going to roll out a consistent season sometime soon.
Let's work on that first.
We're working on that first. We had some really good steam going into season 4, and then we both got insanely busy. By the way, listeners, this is a labor of love. We're not paid for this. If you want to like find us some sponsors and help us get money so that we can actually be more consistent.
Will you buy our embroidered pillows when they finally come out?
Our trucker hats, will you? Yeah.
Belt buckles. There's going to be all kinds of
mugs.
We should make the most random stuff. But anyway,
I want a basketball.
Yeah, see, it's on the nose with the corn cob on.
Yeah. Anyway, all right. Boy, was that a diversion. We're going to bring it back.
You got to love it.
Kurt Vonnegut. Okay, one of the things that really stuck with me when I started learning more about him, and I think it was watching him. So as somebody who loves books, which we've talked about multiple mm-hmm. times, but also as an artist and a comedian, it was like the humor. The humor was so rich in everything. Like, it was really, I'm so impressed. I wish I was like in a class with him just so I could kind of see how he does his joke structure. Like his quips, his wit, they were so sharp and so good. He was with Jon Stewart in an interview, like closer to the end of his life on the Daily Show. And he was being interviewed and he said something so like deep, dark and edgy that Jon Stewart leaned over and he said, "Kurt, it's nice to know that you haven't lost your edge." I mean, it was like, it was beautiful.
Yeah.
You know? Anyway. But also here's the other thing. Visually, doesn't he look like Mark Twain? Like if he was like closer to the, like
towards the end. Yeah. Right? And then there's a lot of comparisons to him. And again, Dan Wakefield does that a lot in the intro of the letters. So yeah, there was a lot there, that satire, that, but also showing like a piece of America, you know, and then just from like a different perspective, and kind of nobody was doing it like that at the time. I mean, I guess, you know, it's a lot. Again, I need to read a little bit more, but there was something else in there too, where it's like, he was a little, what's the word? Maybe annoyed a little that he kind of started getting, labeled and a little pigeonholed into like science fiction.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, well, it's not science fiction. It's a story. And it's just that. So he kind of was always like, the critics like turned on him on one of his books, and it was just kind of always this like battle.
Yeah.
But I thought that he was like, hey, this is what I'm a writer. Like, this is you guys labeling it. You know what I mean? So that part was interesting too.
Yeah.
I think. And it's just like, again, because the need to kind of classify things, and they do that a lot in the publishing industry.
Yeah.
And he's like, can these just be books? Can I just put them out there? Let people read them. And this is, you know, these are stories. These are human stories, whether they take place in outer space or in this or so, you know, the guy traveling time, like, it's just, yeah. So that was kind of cool too. So I really want to read like everything, and he's got quite a repertoire, if you will. So
yeah. Michael, our sound editor and sometimes co-producer, I talked to him because he's read a few of his books, and he was shocked that he knew more than I did about Kurt Vonnegut.
My husband, you know, very upset. He's like, "You haven't read Slaughterhouse-Five?" And I was like, mm. And then again, I retreated to the backyard.
Flogging. Flagellating.
Exactly.
So that was interesting to have his perspective too. I also was really struck because I have the same fascination with like this idea of time and how time is nonlinear, and that idea, particularly like I think is, if I understand it, and I haven't read the book, but just talking to other people, the idea of processing like trauma and how trauma doesn't have a linear presentation in our psyches. And that maybe at the time people didn't understand as much as we do now psychologically about trauma, and how his play with time might really, I'm digging deep.
You are. I'm here for it.
His play with time might actually have something to do with that experience, that human of experience of processing the past, you know, the good and the bad in a very nonlinear fashion, which isn't like science fiction. It's just human. You know what I mean?
Right. No, absolutely. So
that's sort of a fascinating facet to his writing and his life. So anyway, what do you think? Our guest today is Chris LaFave. He is the curator for the Kurt Vonnegut Museum and Library, located in Indianapolis, Indiana. Chris has been studying and speaking about Kurt Vonnegut for over a decade, and has spoken at book festivals, schools, and prisons about Kurt's life story and his influence on American culture and our world. Welcome so much, Chris LaFave.
Thank you for having me.
Welcome, welcome.
We're so glad that you're here, and we're so excited to learn more, because Janice and I have admitted in our first part of our interview that this is a humbling experience for us, and we're getting to know Kurt Vonnegut, who is this cultural icon that we unfortunately never spent a lot of time learning about and are loving learning about him now. So maybe you can give us a little bit, and our listeners a little bit of a history of Kurt's life in Indiana. I'm going to say Indianapolis, but I know that like he had parts of his life other places in Indiana as well. And like help us like sort of form a little background so we can all be in the same place.
Kurt was born into an incredibly prominent Indianapolis family. His great-grandfather, Clemens Vonnegut, hailed from Munster. I was told how to pronounce that properly. Munster, Germany. Came to Indianapolis in 1851 and founded Vonnegut Hardware Store here in 1852. It stayed a family business till the mid-1960s. Kurt actually worked there a couple of summers. He said, "That's where I got my idea of hell from." He said, "Hell is running an elevator throughout eternity in a building with only six floors." He was also a tremendous religious skeptic. I think it's interesting that he served on the Indianapolis Public School Board for 25 years and also wrote a book about his religious skepticism and wrote his own eulogy as well. So he was an interesting character all on his own. Some of the buildings that used to be Vonnegut Hardware Stores are still around. So anyway, Kurt's grandfather and father were really prominent architects here. If you like beer and meat, you definitely want to visit a restaurant called the Raskeller. That is it's known as the Athenaeum today, the larger building. But Kurt's grandfather designed it in 1894. He also designed Heron High School. Kurt's dad was an architect. He was one of the original board members of the Children's Museum here in Indy. So long story short, he married Edith Lieber of the Lieber Beer family. It was arguably one of the most expensive weddings in Indianapolis history. And they had three kids. Bernard Vonnegut, the oldest, turned out to be a brilliant physicist who later discovered that silver iodide could be used to simulate rain. Kurt's older sister, who was Alice, who was an incredibly funny individual and a talented sculptress. And then Kurt himself, born November 11th, 1922, the fourth anniversary of Armistice Day. So he grew up here in a prominent family, had a lot of family around. That impacted him. He said he discovered jazz music at a restaurant called the Southern Barbecue on Meridian. He later referred to music as proof of the existence of God. It was an interesting quote coming from a religious skeptic.
It's pretty wonderful.
He also called jazz safe sex of the highest order. And then he attended Shortridge High School here, where he played clarinet in the jazz band Badly. You have an ever sadistic teacher who he would drunk dial later on in life and tell him how well he turned out.
Wait. His former teacher would – wait. He would call his former teacher to drunk – he would drunk dial him.
Yeah, once
– tell him how successful he was.
Yeah. In Slaughterhouse Five, he talks about that. He talks about how his wife would kick him out of bed because his breath smelled like mustard gas and roses, which was a nice way of saying scotch and water. Okay. And he would call so-and-so throughout his life. And we've learned that over time. Like he would call Morley Safer, the 60 Minutes journalist.
Yeah.
And he would say it was terrific and then hang up the phone immediately after 60 minutes there. He would do the same thing with Joe Petro, the screen printer that he worked with in the 1990s on his visual art. He had to limit his drinking in the 1990s to two per evening, but he very much looked forward to these cocktails. So he'd call Joe Petro at 6:30 and say 30 minutes and hang up the phone immediately. And they'd call him again at 6:45 and say 15 minutes and hang up the phone immediately.
Wow.
So long story short, he served on the Shortridge Daily Echo here in Indianapolis, which was one of the first daily newspapers at a high school in the country, kicking off a lifelong love of journalism. When he graduated in 1940, he was offered a job at the Indianapolis Times, and his family talked him out of accepting it. They said, "You never make a living as a writer." So Kurt actually attended five universities between 1940 and 1947. And received his first degree in 1971.
Wow. So tell me a little bit. I mean, I know that the war probably interrupted his college education, but why five universities and what causes somebody? It's so hard to get into one university. I'm trying to figure out how you do that five times.
Yeah, I've always found it curious as well, but it has to do a little bit with the war and a little bit with his father and his brother. Kurt's father, when the architecture company went belly up during the Great Depression, had some pretty strong feelings about the arts and humanities and how they had completely ruined his life. This was exacerbated by a mood disorder that Kurt's mother suffered from. They really, really struggled with no longer being the rich and powerful Vonneguts of Indianapolis. So, you know, with Kurt's older brother on the fast track to being this, you know, fancy physicist, I think they both kind of pressured Vonnegut to study the sciences. So he got into Cornell, where he picked chemistry. And as far as we can tell, he had got some C's in his freshman year, but they were F's by his junior year. He did call it a beer-soaked time. He had a great time in the fraternity Delta Upsilon. And then he took his work on the Cornell Daily Sun very seriously, which was a separate corporation from the university, actually. Apparently he wasn't quite afraid of being kicked out of Cornell because he could stay at the newspaper. But anyway, he spent the summer of his freshman year at Butler studying journalism. And then early in Kurt's junior year, he got pneumonia, missed a whole lot of class, was not in a rush to go back. Cornell was in no major rush to have him back. And with his draft number coming up, he joined the Army. And the Army sent him to Carnegie and the University of Tennessee for heavy artillery training, a training that he would not use during the war. And he also took engineering courses, and he did poorly in those. And 6 months later, he was shipped off to the Battle of the Bulge, where he was captured nearly immediately.
Wow.
Yeah. Clinton had not killed anybody in World War II. He said bayonets aren't very good against tanks. He also had an uncle that he couldn't stand. When he came back from the war, the uncle said, "You're a real man now. You've been to war." And Kurt said, "I wanted to kill him. He would have been the only German I ever killed."
Is that the same uncle that said he was going to read the book? And then I know he had an aunt that owned a bookstore in Louisville, and they wouldn't carry his books. So
yes,
it seemed like there was a lot of contention with the family.
Yeah, it's actually not the same uncle. The uncle who he dedicated Sirens of Titan to is a phenomenally influential part of his life. Uncle Alex was a Harvard graduate turned insurance salesman who was very optimistic. He was fond of saying, "If this isn't nice, what is?" And I think it had to do, and this is how Mark Vonnegut, Kurt Vonnegut's son, later referred to his father as a pessimistic optimist. He had plenty to be critical about and afraid of and upset about. But he also noticed that people have a habit of failing to notice when they are happy. Vonnegut's uncle would talk about that and say, you know, a chocolate chip cookie is a beautiful thing. And a glass of lemonade on a nice day is a beautiful thing. And he looked at the world from that perspective. He was also the co-founder of Alcoholics Anonymous here in Indianapolis. And that meant a lot to Vonnegut because he was really interested in the concept of artificial families. Because he noticed, especially coming from a kid in the 20s where it was common for families to have 11 kids or a million cousins who lived down the road or what have you, you know, it was no longer as common by the 70s. And that was when he really started to notice that lack of familial everybody around to help you out when life becomes challenging. And he thought, oh, how great would it be to model a society off of the idea of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, and he created that idea for his novel Slapstick in 1976, which garnered him the worst reviews of his career, but I think it's a misunderstood work of genius. He gave everybody millions of family members based on strange last names like Daffodil and Raspberry. And all that came from the funeral of Uncle Alex in the mid-1970s.
It's so interesting. You said two things that I want to go back to. The very first was when you were talking about how his family was really afraid of getting a degree in the arts. And I heard a quote from him. I don't know where he was speaking, but it was something about it was, and I think it was in the 70s or 80s that he said this. He said, if you really want to piss off your parents, then get a degree in the arts. And yeah. I thought that was a fascinating time capsule of a statement.
It still holds up. It still is true.
Oh my gosh. I mean, really. And so that, so I want, I mean, that was something that was really interesting to me, that I had seen and heard and thought, oh, now you've connected it all for me. And I understand why you said that. And then the other thing that I wanted to go back to is this idea of family and community, because it was interesting. I was listening to a little bit of a speech that he had done, a commencement speech at one of the SUNY colleges in New York. And what he had said really struck me, and I had to rewind it two or three times to make sure I had this quote right. But I thought it was so amazing for how significant it was at the time in the 70s and how prophetic it was for where we are now. He said, there are two experiences that will try you most, which are loneliness and boredom. So that commitment to family and community and building that, you know, he was onto something that we're like trying to figure out now in society with this epidemic of loneliness that the Surgeon General is working on. And what is that? Tell me a little bit about that. And are you guys doing something like that at the museum? And then I want to talk about the museum too.
I like to think we're doing that at the museum. I will tell you my favorite part of my job is when people find a moment to tell me about what Vonnegut meant to them. Cause I've answered my questions about Vonnegut for years and years and years. You know, his ability to be funny about subject matters that aren't funny is, you know, I've talked this to death as well, is the idea that some people don't get a sense of humor, and that's fine. But I noticed that the book that made me fall in love with Vonnegut, Cat's Cradle, is fundamentally a book about, you know, religion, weaponry, stupidity, and the end of the world. And yeah, there are only so many people that find that funny. I had to give a presentation on Kurt Vonnegut at a public library on November 7th, 2016 or something along those lines, which if you can, it was the night after the election to give you an idea. And so there was only one topic that anyone wanted to talk about. And they were like, if Kurt Vonnegut was alive today, what would he be discussing? And I've always been so glad that I have the out of saying, The true statement that I believe is that I think he'd be writing about social media. I think he'd be writing, and it's so in my generation's wheelhouse because, you know, we had MySpace and Facebook when I was 20, 21 years old. And it seemed like this incredibly neat thing where you could find your best friend from second grade and your entire family, which a lot of my family lives in Canada. And it seemed like this unbelievable antidote for loneliness and sadness and the idea that you could have permanent interconnectedness with others. And I just think it's hilarious. I don't know that there's too many people who would describe social media in those words today. In fact, not anymore. A lot of people would describe social media in a negative sense. And about how it has revealed something unconscionably ugly about society. And I think Vonnegut would have a lot of fun writing about that.
Interesting. That's something I was actually looking for, a Vonnegut website that was like an official Vonnegut website or, handle on Instagram, because I was trying to see like what kind of social media does the museum put out. And I couldn't find like an official one. Do you guys have an official Instagram account for him or?
Yeah. I think it's just at Vonnegut Library.
Okay. All right. I am now learning. I'm terrible at research on social media, but, but that's consistent. That tracks. But that's interesting about him and social media and being able to find the bright side, sort of that optimistic pessimist, view applied to what's going on now, maybe.
Yeah.
He would have loved Black Mirror, I think, but he would have had there'd have been a funny episode of Black Mirror. I don't know if you've watched it, but that's what it's all about. It's like the technology, like we all had good intentions. And then it's like, oh, nobody ever thought this was like, and some of the stuff that's happened on Black Mirror, I'm like, that happened like a season later.
Yeah.
And the whole AI discussion, everything. Yeah. That would, God. Yeah. I would love to hear his thoughts on that. Cause it seems like he was already kind of writing about that.
Right.
I think he was writing about it from the get-go. I think he was, and so much of it, you know, I read this book, The Brothers Vonnegut, which had to do with you know, when they both worked at General Electric, Kurt is a PR guy from 47 to 51, and Kurt's brother studying the weather and how you can mess with it using science. You know, Vonnegut knew just enough to be terrified of that. And he thought, God, if scientists can mess with the weather, what else are they allowed to mess with?
Right.
And today, you know, I got a very close friend who is employed in AI, and he's a huge believer in it. And we tear each other down because I'm very frightened of it.
So I'm going to segue into the museum because I am so – one of the things is I've been reading about the museum that really fascinates me is just its reach and its ideas. So I would love for you to sort of present that to everybody who's listening who might not know about it. Maybe talk a little bit about its inception, its history, its mission, and what you guys are doing today.
Julia Whitehead, our CEO and founder, back in, 15 years minus 2024. So it would have been 2009 sometime, was reading a story to her kid at bedtime and had the sudden epiphany that, that there was no Vonnegut Museum anywhere. And, she was a medical writer with Eli Lilly, a former Marine, and she kind of put together a board and a Facebook page. And one thing you learn when you're on the ground floor of something is that things don't always move at lightning speed, even though you're shoving your entire body into it and other people are as well. But we did open the original museum in January of 2011. I was there. We had a two-room storefront on Senate Avenue in Indiana in Vermont. It's a three-way stop, which I had a tourist from Belgium ask if that was intentional because of Kurt's famous drawing of a butthole from
that's great.
Which I thought was so. I always tried to come up with reasons. We also had a Pathways to Peace garden across the street, and it was the smallest garden in the history of the world. And I just thought that was hilarious that the Peace Garden was, you know, roughly the size of an elementary school game of Foursquare. So, you know, it was a joyful experience, though. And we got it was interesting to watch the whole thing grow. You know, people immediately turned it into a pilgrimage of sorts. A lot of people talking about how when they went on some kind of a journey in life, Kurt Vonnegut was there. We see a sense of humor connected to people attempting sobriety a lot of the time. Combat veterans healing from the humanities. I know when Julia cold called Mark Vonnegut at his pediatrician's office and asked for permission to do this, one of the major things he did was, I want you to be a veterans advocacy group and an advocacy for free speech. And we bent over backwards to do both of those things.
Wow.
And, you know, for me, it was a lot simpler when Cat's Cradle came out. The economy had tanked and I was living in the neighborhood of Pilsen in Chicago. And, you know, me and my six roommates, I think we had three jobs put together. And it was just kind of a challenging time. And it was kind of funny to read a book about the end of the world around then. So we just sort of grew from there. And so some people are fanatical Vonnegut fans. Some people are curious. Some people are very into World War II history or Indiana history, Indianapolis history. I think that part is fascinating. You know, like when I was young, there was a mentality that in order to have a cool life, you had to live in New York City or Chicago or L.A. or Rome or Tokyo or something like that. And
yep.
It was very interesting to get away from that mentality as you age and just be like, you know what, there's probably something cool in practically every landscape in the future. Exactly. And or the world. My friends and I were taking a road trip through Wisconsin once, and we came across the World Mustard Museum. You know, any place that has a sign on it that says we reserve the right to check you for other condiments is always going to
be classic.
Yeah, it's always going to bring me joy.
See, it's hilarious.
That's beautiful.
It's wonderful.
Oh, yeah. I love little surprises in the Midwest like that. That brings a lot of joy.
Yeah, I'm glad that the Vonnegut Museum is truly one of those. We have the Walker Theater across the way. Madam C.J. Walker was the first African-American millionaire in the United States, I believe. And we're on Indiana Avenue, which was the jazz hubbub of Indianapolis.
So it's so it sounds really, what I love that you've said, if I can sort of paraphrase, is that the museum itself isn't just one thing. It's something that holds interest for a lot of different people with a lot of varied interests. So it's not necessarily the place that you go to for just Kurt Vonnegut memorabilia. It's literally because his life was so expansive and his experiences were so vast. It's a place that encompasses all of those elements.
Yes. I mean, he took education seriously. So we have a partnership with Indianapolis Public Schools, a writer's workshop room. You know, we have the Slaughterhouse Five exhibit dealing with the war. We're in the process of turning our bar into a speakeasy that honors Indiana Avenue and the history there. So yeah, there's a lot that goes on there. It's a very versatile museum. We do a lot of programming. I speak to students, which I really, really love. You know, I especially the older they are, they can handle more mature subject matters. I like to point out rejection letters because I think one thing that kids need to be exposed to is the idea that failure and death are not necessarily synonymous.
I got to pause right there. That is huge because as a parent, and I know you have a younger child, my kids are in the late teen, early 20 college stage. That idea is not present on social media. Right. Yeah. You only see the victories. You only see the successes. And so they feel, I think, more acutely that rejection. I mean, I'm rejected on an hourly basis. Janice, I don't know about you. As comedians, we're acutely prepared for rejection all the time.
Like from people who accepted us, then they reject us. Yeah, exactly. Like, oh, I thought we were okay.
I mean, in any given set on stage, you can be accepted.
I did this yesterday. Yeah.
Rejected 4 minutes later. So, but the fact that you're pointing that out to younger people within the environment of somebody who was so phenomenally successful. Whoa, that's huge. Sorry. I just wanted to shout out to you guys for that.
Well, and he remained very human in the aftermath of Slaughterhouse Five. I've always liked the fact that he, when he became incredibly famous, he tried to answer every letter or, you know, phone calls and what have you. He tried to be friendly with people. I think it had to do with Salinger and when Catcher in the Rye came out and he sort of became a shut-in and he thought, oh, there's no way, after all this toiling in obscurity and being dead poor a lot of the time, there's no way in hell I'm going to do that. So, you know, he bent over backwards to be social and friendly with people. And I like that too. And, yeah, and he did, you know, we have this amazing collection of reviews of his novels, some of which are just gut-wrenching, like, and some of them are afterwards, too. Like, I think Breakfast of Champions, the novel that followed Slaughterhouse Five, is a masterpiece, and it's held in relatively high regard today. But just yesterday in the archive room, I was cataloging this just scathing review of Breakfast of Champions. Like the reviewer is like, I'm not sure it's possible to hate this book more type of thing. And I'm just like
I feel like you're holding back.
this is in the aftermath of the success of Slaughterhouse Five. So Kurt gave Breakfast of Champions a C when he went to go grade his own work. And I think it's so funny whenever I bring up Breakfast of Champions now, there's just people all over the internet saying that book entirely rewired the way I perceive literature. Like when you think about that level of compliment,
yeah,
it's so funny how you know, I'm not really sure what we as a society get out of professional criticism.
Yeah,
right. That would be my next comment. I'm like, who are they representing when you're getting this other feedback of how it's a life-changing thing?
I don't understand that either. One man's trash is another man's treasure type of thing.
And I always wonder, like, who appointed you? Like, just one day you're like, I'm a critic and I got a job. I got critics and stuff. I have a completely different palate than you. I don't know. You're telling me this restaurant isn't good. I loved it. Who are you? Like, why am I listening to you?
Yeah. Because he's being paid to do it.
That's right? It.
He's got to make it
He's got to. I just wanted to circle back really quick, though, too, because I'm on the website about the First Amendment advocacy that you guys do, because especially with everything happening now. But to know it's been obviously been happening since the beginning of time. And I saw that he had, you know, written to the headmaster of Drake High School, and he kind of had these relationships. So his books were burned often? Like, was this like a regular thing? And then I felt like he was personally involved when that happened.
I think the burning probably didn't happen super frequently. And, you know, most book banning happens quietly. You know, right. the vast majority of book banning, you know, people are slightly intelligent enough to do so without drawing a lot of attention to it.
That's a really important thing that you just said. Like, I want to make sure everybody heard that. It happens quietly.
Yeah.
Because I think
being pulled from the library quietly, you don't see it anymore on the shelf. It's not. Because
you know what's real dumb is announcing to the whole universe, hey, you're not allowed to look at this.
Right?
Like, nothing convinces people more that they need to look at something than being told they're not allowed to.
Right. Talk about a light at the end of a dark tunnel. Like, that's exactly where I'm going.
Yeah. I think there's a quote of Vonnegut somewhere saying that most of the censorship you see is just not reading things or choosing not to read things or not ever knowing about them from the get-go. And, you know, that's why I feel so privileged in that regard, because I was able to consume books as much as I wanted as a kid. And as an adult, up until having kids, and even with having kids, I still managed to read sometimes, which is an improvement over not at all. It's almost, I don't know what to say. We had a brick thrown through our window right around the time a bomb threat had been called in to a bookstore here in Indianapolis. We will never know whether those two things were related, but I have a gut feeling that they were. Mm-hmm. And I don't know what that says about our society.
What is the museum doing? I know that you have a festival during Banned Books Week, which I believe is at the beginning of October. Is that correct?
Yeah, end of September, beginning of October. We have a writer or an artist, or in some cases activists, or in one case a band, living in our museum as a protest against censorship. We build a makeshift prison wall made out of books or authors that have been banned. And we do that every year. And then when students come across situations where Slaughterhouse-Five is being challenged, we mail free copies of Slaughterhouse-Five to kids in the area who wanted to read it.
That's so cool.
And I'm pervasively always shocked by the fact, you know, and I say this as someone who've read, I've read Slaughterhouse-Five north of 100 times at this point. And over time, I do want to say that the sex and the time travel and the profanity, some of that falls away and you are left with an incredibly nonfictional autobiographical account of a 22-year-old man who 6 months after the death of his mother is shipped off to one of the most violent battles of World War II, somehow survives but sees all the horrors, and then taken to Dresden, survives the total destruction of that city, has to clean up the remains, and then comes home to Indianapolis and is only, you know, a few months shy of his 23rd birthday. Vonnegut called the book a failure two times in the first 30 or so pages of the novel.
Yeah.
Which I think is hilarious, because of the New York Times, in a glowing review, I think the reviewer said Mr. Vonnegut's having some fun with us. I'm not sure Vonnegut was having fun with people. I think he had been working on the novel for 23 years and was probably pretty blown away that he had to add elements of science fiction and time travel to his autobiographical account as a journalist of his time in World War II. I think that was always shocking to him.
It has been such a pleasure talking to you about all of these things and these ideas. And thank you for giving us a deeper perspective. People can look up a lot of information about what your museum offers. And they can also listen to your podcast.
It's called the Vonnecast. We're hoping for a second season at some point. I'm not sure when that'll start, but you can find us on Spotify and and various other programs as well.
With some terrific guests. You've had Gary Goldman and Lewis Black and some local artists that are nationally and internationally famous. So it's worth a listen, people. Please go out and listen to that. Chris, I can't thank you enough for getting us to think a little bit more and a little deeper about all of this. And it's been fascinating hearing your perspective as an expert and a curator of the museum. So we really appreciate you being here today.
Yeah, absolutely. I hope we get to hang out in Indy or Chicago sometime.
Yeah, that would be great. Sure. Check out the Kurt Vonnegut Museum down in Indianapolis. You can also find them on Instagram, apparently. I can't, but it would be, what's the handle again, Chris, do you think?
It should be at Vonnegut Library. I think Twitter is the same.
It's okay, Vonnegut great. _ library.
Okay, thank you. Yeah,
there that we part. Go. Yeah. Janice is more gifted with that. All right. Thanks, everybody.
Defending Indiana, featuring Colleen Brennan and Janice Rodriguez, is produced by Colleen Brennan and Janice Rodriguez. Theme music and sound editing by Michael Miltenberger. Thanks so much for listening. If you enjoyed what you heard today, you can subscribe to Defending Indiana wherever you find your favorite podcasts.